Thank you, Joe. I'm sure there will be many questions. And I would thank you for the show, especially on Strike Day.
Exactly. I had to come yesterday in order to avoid the strike today. But I try to appreciate why people are striking. And you have many more strikes. We don't have a lot of strikes in America. When I was growing up, there were more strikes. But in the course of my life, there are fewer and fewer strikes. There are fewer and fewer unions. Fewer and fewer people being organized.
We'll talk about it in the next few weeks. Penny?
Thank you very much. It's a very interesting talk. We look forward to reading your book as well. I think there's so many things that one could say. One of the things that strikes me...
No pun intended?
Sorry?
No pun intended?
No.
Okay.
I haven't done it previously. Okay. Yes. First of all, it will be interesting to see the results of today's strike and mm-hmm. just how many people are there, and perhaps not as many as there would have been a few years ago. But this idea of populism that you mm-hmm. you focused on, going back to Andrew Jackson, of mm-hmm. course, and which gives a new interpretation to the American dream, to mm. the Declaration of Independence and so on, and the populist movements, I think that in America one should talk about populism.
Yeah.
And at the end of the 19th century, it was a populist party.
One of the most progressive parties in American history.
Which based its manifesto on the Declaration of Independence, which so many have done, on the Bill of Rights, I should say, the Bill of Rights. And so today this is something that has reoccurred in the United States, but in Europe as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in countries like Italy.
Yeah. Good, mon Dieu.
In France,
Le Pen, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So this is something that's very important and very topical. And the things that you focus on in general
mm-hmm.
Are in a way different. Meet Joe Doe, of course, is something that goes in the same direction as populism.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Capra's films mm-hmm. are
yeah.
populist,
mm-hmm.
and his characters and his actors. I mean, James Stewart has often played this kind of a character.
Mm-hmm.
Facing the crowd and network are going against that. They are more critical. They are critical of these characters, it seems to me. And I think that network is based to a certain extent on Facing the Crowd to a large extent. I think that it's references Facing the Crowd, as does a later film by Spike Lee, Bamboozled,
yeah.
which also has a character on TV with a populist.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think that Spike Lee said that he was influenced by Facing the Crowd. So that is something I think that. That is very interesting to find the to seek the connection of, and so if I were to ask you a question, it would be to what extent does organizing go against populism, or is it in the same is it part of populism? Is it the same vein? That's perhaps one question.
Yeah.
That I might like to ask you. But then the other thing is about class. Class in the United States. And class is something perhaps that is also in many of the European countries is disappearing because so many, I don't know if you ask young people here today, what is a class struggle?
Mm-hmm.
This is a concept that, of course, has disappeared from the mm-hmm. United States. Mm-hmm. But even in France, perhaps, people don't know what class struggle is all about.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes in the United States, it is replaced by something else, by this question of race.
Mm-hmm. Race and gender, about. Yeah.
Yes. Gender. Or, race and gender.
Race, gender, and sexuality.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think those are the questions that confront us.
Superb. Superb. I mean, that is, because I remember having lunch with some of my French friends at their country house in Normandy a year ago, and they were like, populism. I said, please know that one of the most progressive movements in America is in the late 19th century, and that was the Populist Party. So Now, Meet John Doe, I think, in 19... We didn't show any film clips, and I didn't talk about it at length, but I think there are so many contradictions here that I'm working out, but Frank Capra was very conservative. Gary Cooper, who played the lead role, was very conservative.
No, why? Because the French titles always change the films. I was thinking of another film, but it's...
And Gary Cooper's very conservative, and Barbara Stanwyck was very conservative. And they were all in this film. At the same time, Frank Capra closed his set for two reasons. Number one, they were inventing it as they went along. And they had a lot of trouble with the ending that I won't go into. But the other reason was that he didn't want people who were fascists to discover what he was doing with the film. So, and the funny thing, he's conservative, but it's kind of an anti-fascist film. Now, in terms of network, with the I'm mad as hell and I'm not gonna take it anymore, the big group in America that regards that film as their favorite movie is the Tea Party, That's what they find most inspirational. And so what do you do? See, as I read it, capitalism needs to get people fed up. It needs to get people angry. It needs there to be a lot of friction in its machinery so then it can sell all of the lubrication that keeps the machinery going. And that has to do with soft power, the importance of what's the solution in your life. Find the right partner, find the right romance, the privatization of aspiration and commitment, the individualizing of aspiration and commitment, not thinking of the whole as something that has to be changed, looking for your personal solutions to systemic problems. This is all part of what I think of as Americanization. So you're absolutely right. You've got two forces who are, and the Republicans are very effective in their use of cultural politics, more effective as cultural analysts over the last 20 years than many of the progressive people in terms of their abilities to organize. And so what lessons can be learned about, because even like in terms of what you talked about the youth in Europe today, this is another larger topic, but the British New Left is something I've written about a great deal in one of the books that I've written, Critique for What? And the American Left and the rise of radical critique and Britain and America and the way it goes back and forth. And the reason why they developed in British New Left cultural studies is because they saw exactly what you're describing in the late 1950s. And they were thinking these American films, these American TV shows, these American comic books, and British versions of them, this is what people are getting interested in right now. And they're not thinking in terms, why can't socialism have a chance in Britain? And why do we need to reinvent socialism? Because people have different interests. They're no longer identifying as members of a class. So you need to figure out what they're identifying with in order to better intervene in those constructions of interest and constructions of fascination and those constructions of preoccupations. And so that was how cultural studies was then born in the university by members of the British New Left that entered academia. And people like Raymond Williams and Stuart Hall and E.P. Thompson were trying to think more along those lines. And that's something that shaped me in my own project. So they're thinking about, it's not only what kind of critique do we need, then what do we do with that critique, and how do we get it out there? And his, Stuart Hall, who just died a couple of years ago, who was from the Caribbean, and he was a Rhodes Scholar, and remained in Britain, his term for what he was trying to do, he was trying to think about the ways in which hegemony works, or hegemonizing. But really what he was thinking about to add to that was counter-hegemonizing. How do you counter-hegemonize? So I think we have to learn from what people are identifying with and are getting interested in, and see that that's a reality that might change over time, but how do you use that which exists? And these films are really about this, because in the end, it's the women who turn off the machines. But again, going back to a great movie about a miners' strike in New Mexico with migrant workers, with mostly Mexicans who crossed the border, and they're on strike, and the white workers in other mines aren't going to support them. So there's all sorts of divisions, and they're going to make some bad decisions. And then the women say, no, we'll go on the strike lines. We're the ones who are going to be out there and let the police try to arrest us, and the police do arrest them. So there's this long tradition of, it's so interesting, these films, as they're trying to work out what works in terms of organizing. I think we might be able to learn something from films, but there are very few films, relatively speaking, about this sort of thing. But so you're right. So you've got very fascistic populism, but then you've got other kinds of populism that can be progressive, and that's a real battle. Who's going to win? I don't know. But the more we know about how to reach people, and movies are very good at reaching people, that's what I'm hoping my book will contribute to a little bit. Not only what are the problems with America that we could address that would maybe make it live up to its advertising campaign, but then how do you bring about social change once you understand what has to be changed? And how do you, an old term, something that used to interest socialists a great deal, that's not a major term anymore, is incentive. How do you build incentive? Because there used to be old debates in the early 20th century between socialists and capitalists, let's say lieutenant governors versus some socialist leaders, about capitalist incentive and individualism, the idea that you only have incentive if it benefits yourself. And then the socialists would say, no, you've got a false individualism. We've got the kind of individualism where we can develop the incentive to develop a collectivity in which nobody is an individual at someone else's expense. So the word incentive used to be very important, I would say, up through the 1930s in socialist discourse. And then it sort of disappeared. But I think some of these films, these movies, can tell us a lot about how incentive is developed. And sometimes when I talk to my students about incentive, I tell them a story about my wife. It doesn't have to do with a movie. It has to do with a rock group. And the rock group is the Rolling Stones. And when my wife was very young, she grew up in Akron, Ohio. She's American, lived in Paris for many, 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 many years, loves Paris, loves the French, just is so happy to be here. And her boyfriend and his friend waited all night online to get Rolling Stones tickets. The whole night, they just camped out to get the tickets for themselves and their girlfriends. And then they got in the front row, and Mick Jagger threw my wife some flowers, and they saw this great Rolling Stones concert, and Stevie Wonder was the opening act for the Rolling Stones, and they liked him even more than the Rolling Stones, and it was a great night, and the boyfriend stayed out all night. I'll say to my students, what is it in your life? What are you interested in, and how did that happen? And what are you not interested in, and how did that happen? And start scrutinizing that. And what is it that could make you stay up, except for maybe an exam? And that's a good thing. It's a really good thing to write a great paper. But what could make you stay up all night? What gives you incentive in your world? Is it video games? Is it the movie that you can't wait to see? Is it the rock concert you can't see? Like, what happened to making the world a better place? And why isn't it, like, you say, no, is this the production of resignation? I can't change that. That's life. But I want to see this great movie on Friday. I want to see this great video. Oh, this great video game is so cool. It's très cool. You know, I want to get that. You know, so what is it that excites people? And how do you learn about that and intervene in that? And that's what a lot of the American writers and filmmakers and playwrights are teaching me to think about. So it's their fault. But thank you. That's a great question.
For your paper, I couldn't help but notice that it's Andy Griffith who plays the face in the crowd, who is the quintessential 1950s man.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wondered if you had made some analysis of the fact that Andy Griffith was trying to play the role in that film.
Well, it's interesting. He had not been in films. He was in a musical on Broadway. He had like a kind of a secondary role, and I can't remember, maybe Ilya Kazan had seen, you know, it was something, or Bud Schulberg, the screenwriter, had seen him and said, I think he's going to work. And this is one of the greatest performances in American film. And then he went on to play a sheriff in a town called Mayberry in the South, who would dispense kind of good advice. He was a really good guy. And then later in his career, he would play, another role. I can't remember exactly what. I don't watch TV that much. But he had a TV career. But this is one of the greatest performances ever. And what he did just before he died, he only died about 3 or 4 years ago, but one of the last things he did was with the young boy who played his son in the original series, became the great director, Ron Howard, who was also in some important movies before he became a director. So, and his son was named Opie. And he did, one of the last things he did was a TV ad for Obama to try to get him elected, which he did get elected the second time. And he appeared with Ron Howard with a wig, the grown-up one, playing like little, hey, dad, giving you advice. But he was very much on the kind of progressive side of things. But when I think about Face in the Crowd, part of me thinks about Donald Trump, and part of me thinks about George W. Bush, and is a very interesting film, not a great one, but an interesting film by the director and screenwriter Oliver Stone about George Bush the second, right? And George Bush, he's born in New Haven, he went to Yale, he went to Harvard Business School, and he failed at many, many things. His family's related to the Queen of England. His grandfather supported the Nazis. His grandfather dug up the skull of Geronimo to bring it back to a secret society at Yale. He's got this strange past. So he goes back to Texas and he runs for Congress. He runs for Congress as a Republican, and he doesn't win. And his opponent says, hey, you know, you're this blue blood. You're this American aristocrat from New Haven, Riley, in Connecticut. You know, like, you don't belong down here. And so the Oliver Stone, I'm not sure if he actually said this, George Bush, but he says, okay, from now on, I'm going to out-Texas, Texas. I'm going to out-Texas, Texas. Again, the dress down. And George Bush became the man you want to have a beer with, even though since he was arrested for drunk driving, he doesn't really drink very much anymore, if at all. So I often think about his own, the way in which he had an inability to finish a coherent, cogent sentence and could never speak in anything like a paragraph. The way in which his dressed-down politics, because he's so inarticulate, he must be telling the truth. He must be authentic. He's not putting on airs. He's informal. And just before 9/11, there was footage of him chopping trees in his property in Texas with his little cowboy hat on. And it seemed like he's going to ride a horse. But the truth is, he doesn't know how to ride a horse. He only knows how to ride a pickup, probably only with automatic drive. But so I think of George Bush when I think of that movie. And Trump is a funny kind of amalgam of the two. But Andy Griffith did the part really well. And I think that was a really bold choice, because I think it's one of the most important films ever made. in America. And I think it's one of the best performances ever given. And I don't, people give him credit, but not the credit he deserves. Now he's dead, but he's like, this is extraordinary. And he was never given a chance to do anything like that again. It was always the TV roles. But he was very good at speaking in that kind of dressed down, colloquial, the colloquializing of power, the kind of entertainment, getting people to identify with him. And it's interesting the way the character Lonesome Rhodes got people to identify with him. Because one of the first things he did, again in terms of gender, is when at first he has a radio show. He's in his first radio show, and again he's been a hobo, he's been arrested, he's in jail. In his radio show, he said, it's in the early morning, and he doesn't even want to work, he doesn't believe in work, but he does this radio show. He says, I want to speak to all you women out here. All you women who are doing all of this labor that goes unrecognized. Here you are cooking and cleaning and doing all of this work that your men folk don't even kind of value. And I want to say, I'm eating this cake that you sent me, and it's so good. And I really love you all, and I appreciate you all. And he gets the women to support him. Meanwhile, he's looking down on them a lot. And then when he gets his first TV show, one of the first things he does is a black woman, this is in the South, this is in Nashville, whose house burned down. And what he does is he raises money for the black woman in the Jim Crow system, where you're not supposed to do anything like that. So people are thinking here, again, almost like Donald Trump, this is kind of anti-establishment. He doesn't fit the system. He's a good guy. He knows how to manipulate that all the time. And one of the greatest things he does is that there was a big amusement park in Brooklyn where I grew up called Coney Island. And there's this famous steeplechase character with this gigantic grin. And Andy Griffith has this incredible grin that's also in another kind of stereotype that Richard Wright, the great African-American writer, hated. He called it hardiness, where you're supposed to grin no matter how much, as an African-American in the Jim Crow South, no matter how much discrimination you face, you've got to be hardy and grin and smile. And that constructed cheerfulness was something he reviled. But Lonesome Rhodes manipulates that with that grin, and Andy Griffith does an amazing job of that. So he's like, this is like the perfect performance. He did say once that in order to be in role, he convinced Ilya Kazan in the final scene where he falls from power that he would actually do some drinking. He's supposed to be getting drunk. He's depressed because he realizes he's lost all of this. He's been exposed. And he was doing, and this, it was no good. The scene went bad, and he had to do it all over again. So he's, you know, so I admire Andy Griffith a lot. He doesn't get the credit he deserves. This is like anything that, and I love like John Gielgud. I love Sir Ralph Richardson. I love Laurence Olivier. These are, Ian McKellen. This performance is as good as anything. And so I'm real British, pro-British, when it comes to acting ability. This is as good as anything I've ever seen in my entire life. It's phenomenal. He really clued in to what needed to be exposed as a way of getting people to identify with the form of power that's so dangerous because it doesn't seem like power. The form of power that doesn't seem like power. America's very good at that.
Final question? Yes?
Maybe.
Yes, I have perhaps a comment and a question that I would like to begin by saying how much I enjoyed your lecture. You'll realize how little I know about movies, so please, you know. The comment concerns the rate of unionization. You said that in the U.S. about 10% of workers are unionized.
10.7%. And most of those, something like 6 or 7%, are government workers. So that's how bad it is.
Do you know how much it is in France?
No.
It's between 7 and 8%.
Between 7 and 8%.
Yeah. It's actually less than in the US.
Wow.
The question I have is, you showed us several scenes from the movie Norma, right? I've never seen it, and you know, the welcome it received at Cannes, and I didn't recognize the actress. You mentioned she wasn't well known.
Sally Fields was a TV star who played the Flying Nun. And it was a sort of a nun who was, it's just kind of a silly role. And then she agreed to do it, and then she just fell in love, not literally, but figured, with the director, Martin Ritt, and then she appeared in some of his later films. She's like, he gave her her big chance, but she also believed, she's said a lot of things that have been more, she's very progressive and become more feminist, so a part had an impact. Well, something like Andy Griffith, like somebody's like given a, given a real chance, and she's not, I don't think she's from the South, so she had to adapt to that. And the film was actually filmed in Alabama. But go ahead.
And you said that several famous actresses actually declined the role.
Jane Fonda and Susan Sarandon, they were busy as well.
It wasn't because of industry pressure not to do that movie?
I don't know all of the explanations, I just know they turned it down. But at the same time, they were very, you know, I'm not trying to indict them or condemn them, but they were busy. But they needed, you know, like a film, if you've got the big star, and like Facing the Crowd didn't have the big star at the time. It had some people who would later become bigger, but Norma Rae didn't have the big star. It wasn't supposed to be successful. It was supposed to be, you know, so-so. And it won all the awards. Yeah, but I'm sorry.
Yes, no. The question was, you know, why he had to recruit, you know, actors who weren't that well known. Mm-hmm. Was deliberate on his part. No, since he contacted Jane Fonda, they declined the role.
Yeah,
because of their.
It's hard to tell why. Yeah, I mean, I'd actually have to. I'm not sure. Maybe I'd have to do more research into that. In other words, the film was what we call a sleeper. A sleeper, something that wasn't supposed to be like, wow, this is a success, but we didn't think it would be a success. And what's even more interesting about it is that the next year, Margaret Thatcher would get elected that year, and Ronald Reagan would get elected the next year. And he spent all 8 years of his presidency crushing unions. So, I mean, America is full of contradictions. I've spent my whole life, we're talking about how long we've been doing things, you know, saying American studies, there's so much. I'm still having trouble figuring out how Ronald Reagan got elected, no less George Bush, no less Donald Trump. I'm supposed to know these things, but I'm also from Brooklyn, so maybe I've got more of an ethnocentric Brooklyn, New York perspective, almost like the union organizer who came to North Carolina trying to, you know, call this guy a schlemiel, which is not the way you get someone to, you know, let you into his house and get his support. Yeah, Ronald Reagan, yeah, busted unions, beginning with the air traffic controllers. So you've got this as a huge success, and again, a huge success in France, which, and the Cannes Festival is international, of course, but people saw this, and were thinking like, we're not, you know, like, we don't see stuff like this. We don't see stuff like this. And they went wild. So it was a huge success at Cannes. Sally Fields got the Oscar, and I'm pretty sure I think got some other Oscars as well. And it was a further success for Martin Ritt, who had been blacklisted with the McCarthy House Un-American Activities Committee hearings in the 1950s. So how do you explain, like, okay, it's a huge success in 1979, and it's not supposed to be. In 1980, Ronald Reagan gets elected. Well, the things happened with Jimmy Carter and the Iran hostage crisis, and there are other things. And then, but at the same time, what was happening is the Republicans were learning from Martin Luther King, who in the 1950s, how do you begin to organize against Jim Crow in the South? Well, you organize by doing at least two things. Number one, you get people together who are already organized. And those are people in the black churches who are already organized in the church, and you connect those dots. And the other thing you have is that you get people who are in protesting, get it to be filmed, get it on TV. So if there are horrible things that happen, the world can now see it. The world is the audience. And what the Republicans learned, okay, we like the idea of the churches. We're going to get the white conservative churches together after Gold War lost in 1964. And we're going to connect those dots. And that built and built and built. And then you got Richard Nixon in 1968. And he gets kicked out in around 1974 after Watergate. And then Ford is in for a while. Carter wins until 1980. Then Reagan wins. The churches have built up. That's not the only, but they're built up. So, but you still, you have, again, it's like the war in America. And there are so many Americans that we're going over this in our graduate class, the extent to which America is a kind of war zone in which, to use the term that people might not identify with anymore, you've got a lot of people saying, for example, Theodore Dreiser, the great American novelist, said before America entered into World War II, he said, before you go into World War II, you have to stop the class war at home, the war at home. And he wrote a book in 1941, near the end of his life, and the title of the book was America is Worth Saving. And the sad implication of that title is, what must America be saved from? Itself. And the great African-American novelist Ralph Ellison said the same thing around the same year. He said, okay, it looks like we're headed toward war. You want African-Americans to participate in this war? You have to stop the war at home, the war against African-Americans. So, and in a lot of the labor films, there's at some point where violence will occur. And sometimes that will be, especially when it's reported, what will end the strike. And the strike will win, but it's because violence will have occurred. So for all of my emphasis on soft power and soft capitalism, I don't want to underplay the fact that there's an ideological war in America. One of the more recent statistics is that 1% of the population owns 42.7% of the wealth. It's very interesting. The more you learn about the world, I didn't know about France. I was teaching in China a few years ago, and they said that's the same percentage in China. So how do these things happen? How do people go along with them, these things? And that's part of what I'm trying to think about in the book, how people go along with their own subjugation, perhaps by not defining it as subjugation and getting certain compensations, like, I don't like what I'm doing, I can't believe I'm going to spend the whole life what I'm doing, but there's this movie I want to see on Friday night that's really cool, and I've got this date, and maybe I can score after the date. And on that note...
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.